they came together again to celebrate their first birthday, dancing and prancing in Central Park. Happy birthday, Kasia and Zazu Goodpup. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for two positions, Director of Finance and Administration and a Human Resources Manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maritim, Maria Teresena, Tammy Warnock, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamer Yastu, Joe John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman.
David Brower, David R. Brower, and I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States, and that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland, and I wish you had a lot more company.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
It's the Fall KBOO Drive, and our theme is the sounds of democracy. Everything you hear on KBOO is, in its own way, the sound of democracy, because we are a community radio station. Community is one of the most democratic types of media. We're non-commercial and independent. We're supported by our members so that we can keep the airwaves democratic and continue to bring you the valuable voices of your community. Democracy is an experiment, and so is community radio. We're featuring content focused on democracy itself and democratic ideas across the schedule this drive. You can support KBOO by donating right now. Go to kboo.fm/give, or on your mobile phone, text KBOO to 44321, or click donate in the KBOO mobile app. Thank you for supporting your community radio station.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, 200 city and county workers in the Portland area may lose their jobs Monday as the vaccine mandate takes effect. Jackson County requests a statewide emergency to combat illegal marijuana operations. And in national news, the Parkland shooting suspect will plead guilty to all charges. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 15th, 2021. KBOO is currently in the last 2 days of our fall fund drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Sam Bowman. Over 200 employees for the city of Portland and Multnomah County seem to be poised to lose their jobs on Monday when the vaccine mandate takes effect. 92% of employees for the city and the county have been vaccinated ahead of their vaccine deadlines. Between 5 and 7% of workers submitted an exemption and were approved. The mandates were put in place in August when the Delta variant of coronavirus was taking a huge toll and after full FDA approval of the Pfizer vaccine. Officers in the Portland Police Bureau and Multnomah County Sheriff's Office are exempted from the vaccine mandate because of a legal loophole. It is unclear how many law enforcement officers in the area are vaccinated. Monday, the 18th, is also the deadline for healthcare workers in the state. 84% of healthcare workers in the county have gotten vaccinated ahead of the mandate so far, which is a relatively strong rate. Even so, it could still result in thousands of layoffs for healthcare workers. Executive branch employees were originally scheduled to have the same vaccination deadline as other groups under the governor's mandate, but union deals pushed their deadline to November 30th. Advisors to the Food and Drug Administration have urged the regulatory organization to give emergency use authorization for booster vaccines made by Moderna and Pfizer. The FDA has already granted emergency approval for vaccine boosters of the Pfizer vaccine for at-risk groups, including the immune compromised and suppressed, people with comorbidities, and individuals older than 65. Foreign travelers will be allowed into the U.S. starting on November 8th, providing they are fully vaccinated. Travelers will have to show proof of vaccination, and those visiting by air will need a negative COVID test result within 3 days of entering the U.S. This is welcome news for cities that rely on tourism for revenue and for families that have been separated by the travel bans that have limited international travel since the pandemic began. Jackson County declared a state of emergency because of illegal marijuana farms and is asking the state of Oregon to do the same. The state of emergency was announced at a meeting on Wednesday where county commissioners described the difficulties with illegal grow operations in their region. Jackson County Sheriff Nathan Sickler estimated that there were roughly 1,000 marijuana and hemp farms in Jackson County between the legal and illegal ones. Illegal marijuana farms often pose as hemp distributors, which means their plants would have to have less than 5% THC, the chemical in cannabis that creates the high. When the Oregon Liquor Control Commission went out and tested the contents of legal hemp farms in Jackson and Josephine counties, about a third had too high of the THC content. The emergency declaration the county seeks from the state is to help with more personnel for code enforcement, water resources staff, detectives, and support staff for law enforcement. Many of these illicit grow operations are connected to the black market for marijuana in other states in the U.S., where it hasn't been legalized for recreational use. County Commissioner Rick Dyer says the illegal marijuana farms cause a lot of problems. He cited environmental damage, fire hazards, forced labor, and water theft. That last one is especially pertinent because of the severe drought Oregon is enduring. The state hasn't responded to the ask for an emergency declaration yet, but the legislature passed a helpful law to combat illegal marijuana farms in June. House Bill 3000 requires that growers have a state license to grow either marijuana or hemp. Before that bill, it was very difficult to figure out which of the plants farmers were growing and what market they were intended for. The shooter who killed 17 at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida in 2018 will plead guilty to all charges, his lawyer says. The school shooting was one of the deadliest in American history. Nicholas Cruz killed 17 of his former teachers and classmates and injured 17 others. He's charged with 17 counts of premeditated murder and 17 counts of attempted murder. The official plea will be entered in a hearing next week, and a guilty plea would result in a short trial. Prosecutors have said they will seek the death penalty. Many of the students who survived the shooting became activists around gun control, with some creating the group March for Our Lives. The survivors expressed in a statement that they were, quote, appalled and disgusted that lawmakers have not made change to reduce gun violence. They wrote, quote, a single guilty plea does not bring closure, as it is still possible for another person anywhere in this country to be murdered by a gun at school, in a place of worship, or in their very own home, end quote. Environmentalists have high hopes for President Biden at an upcoming climate summit. A bipartisan panel cautions against court packing, and a Trump ally is held in contempt of Congress for ignoring a subpoena. With more on this story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The world will be watching to see if the U.S. will lead again, to see if the U.S. will cooperate with other nations and deliver on its international climate commitments.
The president of the Sierra Club, Ramon Cruz, is looking for President Joe Biden to walk into upcoming climate talks with historic investments in his briefcase. The president and first lady will travel to Europe in 2 weeks for the COP26 summit, where global leaders will discuss ambitious climate action, including the administration's goal of cutting U.S. carbon emissions in half by 2030. National climate advisor Gina McCarthy contends intensifying natural disasters are proof of just how high the stakes are.
And I'm not just talking about how we hand our children a future that we're proud of, but right here and right now, we have to protect our health. We have to protect our homes and our communities. We have to figure out how to work now if we hope to have success in shaping a sustainable future.
Before the summit, Biden will travel to the Vatican to meet with Pope Francis to discuss human rights and ending the pandemic. A bipartisan panel studying potential reforms to the Supreme Court says there are considerable risks to expanding the number of justices. Preliminary findings said court packing could undermine the high court's legitimacy and lead to a continuous cycle of future expansions. The House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol riot will hold political strategist Steve Bannon in contempt for refusing to comply with a subpoena. Committee chair Democratic Congressman Benny Thompson said the committee will use every tool at its disposal to get the information it requests.
We need to know minute by minute how January 6th unfolded. We need to understand how the rotten lie behind January 6th has continued to spread and feed the forces that would undermine American democracy.
Bannon's lawyer advised the panel his client will not provide testimony or documents until the committee reaches an agreement with former President Donald Trump over executive privilege or a court weighs in on the matter. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says the chamber will vote next week on whether to debate a new election reform bill aimed at countering the growth of state-level Republican voting restrictions. Schumer warned Republicans failure to advance the legislation would prompt him to find a way to move it forward without them. The November general election is just around the corner, and the Virginia governor's race is in the national spotlight, with Democrat Terry McAuliffe and Republican Glenn Youngkin neck and neck. Jim Dow with Virginia AARP hopes voters will turn out.
After what we've seen in this country over the last however many years, where we've become increasingly divided, and hopefully by looking at elections as an opportunity to evaluate candidates based on their positions, their policy solutions, I think we'll find as a people that there's a lot more that unites us than divides us.
I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support accuracy and transparency online at publicnewsservice.org.
Voting rights advocates are calling for investigations into major discrepancies in voter registration rejection rates in Ohio. Cuyahoga, Franklin, and Montgomery counties specifically had high numbers of rejected registrations sent in from designated public agencies. Mary Sherman has the story.
A high percentage of rejected voter registrations in three of Ohio's biggest counties is raising some red flags. According to the Election Administration and Voting Survey, in 2019 and 2020, a majority of online or in-person registrations in Ohio were accepted, while those registrations sent by mail, the DMV, or public agencies were more likely to be rejected. Specifically, 18% of registrations from designated public agencies were not approved. Kayla Griffin with All Voting is Local Ohio explains that more than half of those rejections came from Cuyahoga, Franklin, and Montgomery counties.
These are state agencies or agencies that folks are entrusting, whether they're the schools or the public libraries. They should be the ones who are best equipped, aside from the Board of Elections, to really carry out and facilitate these voter registrations.
The organization is calling for the board of directors in the three counties to investigate the agencies, as well as requesting the release of information related to the rejections. Griffin says the hope is that the issues can be rectified to ensure access to the ballot is not being hindered. She adds the rejections could be the result of missed deadlines or a need for additional training for volunteers and workers.
If they're not filling out the forms properly, are they also being alerted that this form wasn't accepted? You need to do it again. I doubt it, but we don't know. And so we want the boards to start asking some of those questions.
All Voting is Local sent their requests in letters to Board of Election officials in Cuyahoga, Franklin, and Montgomery counties, as well as Ohio election leaders.
Secretary of State is the chief oversight for elections, so if we don't hear back from the boards, we will escalate it to the Secretary of State and ask that their office look into this and figure out what's going on.
At the national level, about 3% of all registrations were invalid or rejected. At directed public assistance agencies, about 9% were invalid or rejected. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. This is Mary Sherman for Ohio News Connection.
Over 10,000 John Deere and Company workers over 14 plants across the Midwest went on strike Thursday after the union overwhelmingly rejected a contract that would have unequally raised wages across the workforce. The machine manufacturing giant continued to employ its essential workers throughout the pandemic despite health risks and global supply shortages. Workers reported working longer hours over the last year due to staffing shortages. During this time, John Deere reported record profits in the first three quarters of 2021, bringing in $4.7 billion, over $1 billion in profit more than their highest record year in 2013. In addition to wage raises, the striking workers are also bargaining against cuts to post-retirement health care and pension benefits. The last strike amongst John Deere workers was organized by the United Auto Worker Union 35 years ago. The John Deere strike represents the largest private sector strike since 2019. You're listening to a special Fall Fund Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, and we'd like to remind you that you can become a member or renew your KBOO membership at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines, produced by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. At 6 o'clock, it's KBOO's Hispanic and Latinx Heritage Month series. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of 48 degrees. Tomorrow, those clouds continue, but we will see a high of 68 degrees. Today in history, in 2001, NASA's Galileo spacecraft passed within 180 kilometers of Jupiter's moon Io. The quote of the day is from English novelist and humorist P.G. Wodehouse, who was born this day in 1881. In his novel, Jeeves and the Unbidden Guest, he wrote, quote, "I'm not absolutely certain of the facts, but I rather fancy it's Shakespeare who says that it's always just when a fellow is feeling particularly braced with things in general that fate sneaks up behind him with the bit of lead piping," end quote. New changes to the U.S. Postal Service will have the biggest impact on first-class mail, which alarms some Oregonians who work for the USPS ahead of the busy holiday season. Emily Scott has more.
Ahead of the busiest season of the year for the U.S. Postal Service, some Oregon postal workers are voicing concerns about the latest policy changes. They include new service standards that slow down first-class mail delivery. Mail traveling less than 1,000 miles should reach its destination in 3 days, and mail traveling more than 1,900 miles will take about 5 days. The Postal Service has also hiked rates for mail, packages, and other special services. Joe Kogan of Portland's local postal workers union says with these changes and staffing issues, he doesn't think the Postal Service is prepared for the holiday crunch.
I just don't know how any organization or business can survive if you're reducing service and charging more. It just doesn't make sense to me. I can tell you that the employees that I represent, you know, we want to serve our customers to the best of our ability, and we believe that this action prevents us from doing that.
Postmaster General Louis DeJoy has said the Postal Service is hiring 40,000 seasonal workers to help with the holiday rush, and that the changes are needed to trim a $160 billion loss by 2030. Christopher Shaw is an author and historian of the U.S. Postal Service and says he's already hearing reports of how these changes are affecting small business owners. They often depend on first-class mail and have said the slowdown will impact their day-to-day operations. Shaw thinks some may turn to other delivery providers, which could lead to further privatization of the industry.
These changes are part of a trend where the Postal Service is conceived of not as a public service, and instead more like a for-profit business, which could very well lead to a degradation of the service that Americans have expected and received over the years.
The changes are part of DeJoy's 10-year plan called Delivering for America, which includes modernizing the vehicle fleet and making investments in mail processing facilities. I'm Emily Scott with Oregon News Service.
The U.S. House of Representatives released a memo revealing that the federal government doesn't regulate the safety of tear gas or have meaningful data on its health impacts. The House Oversight Subcommittee on Economic and Consumer Policy released the memo on Thursday, showing that not only is tear gas unregulated by the government, there hasn't been a comprehensive study on the negative health impacts. The subcommittee opened the probe in response to the use of tear gas in over 100 cities in just the first 6 months of 2020, and the rising concern about its effect on the endocrine, gastrointestinal, and reproductive systems of its victims. Tear gas is banned in war by international treaty. The memo also detailed that manufacturers of the chemical weapon have never disputed the risks of injury and negative health outcomes involved when the weapon is used. The subcommittee sent letters to leading manufacturers and federal regulation agencies requesting health and safety information of the products. The Blackfeet Nation's chief of over 40 years, Earl Oldperson, is remembered as a respected leader and culture bearer. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamerick with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamerick in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Blackfeet Nation's chief of over 40 years, Earl Oldperson, died Wednesday at the age of 92 after a long battle with cancer. Aaron Bolton reports Oldperson was a longtime leader for the tribe in northwest Montana and worked hard to keep Blackfeet language and traditional culture alive.
If you attended any large gathering or event on the Blackfeet Nation, you were likely to hear Chief Earl Oldperson welcome tribal members and guests. That welcome was usually accompanied by a song like the one he sang during Grand Entry at North American Indian Days in 2019.
He had this kind of a genius type of ability to hear Indian music and store that in his mind, you know, but just hear it once.
Blackfeet Tribal Historic Preservation Officer John Murray says Oldperson was able to hold on to vast amounts of traditional Blackfeet knowledge through the 1950s and into the 1970s, when much of Blackfeet culture and language was lost.
But Earl stayed close to it, and he's been an advocate for promoting the language, and was able to retain them songs, so when the culture started coming back, they would go to him.
Oldperson became the chief of the tribe in 1978, but also had a storied career as a political leader for the tribe. He served on the Blackfeet Tribal Business Council for decades, starting in the 1950s. He became the president of the National Congress of American Indians from 1969 to 1971, and worked on national pieces of legislation like the American Indian Religious Freedom Act of 1978. His nephew, Terry Tansey, remembers him as a dedicated family man that enjoyed the ranching lifestyle and had a deep love of horse culture. He says Oldperson lived by a simple phrase he heard growing up in the 1930s.
They would all say their language. And what that means is, good morning, get up, try hard.
Tansey says that phrase reflects the legacy his uncle left behind. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
At the annual convention of the National Congress of American Indians, Quinault Vice President Fawn Sharp was elected to her second term as president. Mark Macaro, chairman of the Pechanga Bang of Luiseno Indians, was newly elected first vice president. Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians chairperson Aaron Payment and Stockbridge Muncie Band of Mohican Indians president Shannon Holsley were elected recording secretary and treasurer. Sharp spoke about the challenges tribes have faced during the coronavirus pandemic, but also said she believes the coming years will be an era of reconciliation, restoration, and healing for Indigenous people. In a suburb of Atlanta this week, a county commission voted to remove a relic from a downtown square that critics have dubbed the Genocide Cannon. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reports the cannon has ties to the Indian War of 1836, in which 3,500 Native Americans died and also led to the Trail of Tears. The DeKalb County Commission voted to remove the cannon, which was placed on the square in 1906 by the Daughters of the Confederacy. And in Mexico City, a statue of Christopher Columbus will be replaced by a female pre-colonial indigenous figure. The New York Times reports the statue will be a larger replica of a stone carving found earlier this year in the state of Veracruz. It dates to the time of Columbus's voyages more than 500 years ago. The move follows the reversal of an earlier decision by the government to commission a work of an indigenous woman for the site. Hyperallergic reports that brought condemnation by artists, writers, and curators who signed an open letter last month month opposing the selection of a male artist who did not identify as Indigenous. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
Food banks that work with Feeding America saw a 31% increase in the amount of food distributed in the first quarter of 2021 compared with the same period of 2020. Roz Brown has more on the story in New Mexico.
As the pandemic wanes, hunger and food insecurity are also on the decline, but the need is still far above pre-pandemic levels, especially for people of color. Amy McReynolds with Feeding America says despite the recent decreases, the amount of food being distributed by the organization's partner food banks remained more than 55% above pre-pandemic levels.
The pandemic seemed to worsen the conditions for people of color in this country. African Americans went from 2.5 times to 3.2 times more likely to be food insecure.
McReynolds adds that Latinos went from 2 to 2.5 times more likely to be food insecure during the same period. Feeding America reports that 38 million people were food insecure before the pandemic, and almost 60 million people turned to a charitable feeding system for assistance in 2020. Feeding America works with more than 200 food banks across the country. She is confident that various interventions allowed people to have enough to eat, but worries that food insecurity could increase all over again if more setbacks occur, such as expiration of eviction moratoriums and expanded unemployment benefits.
The racial wealth gap just really continues to widen for people of color who are seeing higher rates of unemployment, limited earning potential, and continued lack of access to home ownership.
In addition to food banks, the government-led food program known as SNAP, or food stamps, saw an increase of 7 million users between 2019 and 2021. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Ghost forests are an eerie sign of rising seas. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Along the Atlantic coast, ghost forests provide haunting signs of sea level rise. These stands of bleached and broken tree trunks are all that remain after salty water inundates a forest. Matt Kerwin is with the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. He says ghost forests are not a new phenomenon, but they're moving inland faster as seas rise.
Eventually they'll fall apart and become stumps surrounded by marshland. And so when you see a ghost forest now, you're seeing where the marsh will be in the future.
Marshes are valuable ecosystems. So in some ways, that's positive.
Ghost forests are a surprising indicator of ecological resilience in coastal systems. They mark how marshes naturally migrate in response to sea level rise.
But that migration comes at a cost.
Places that people have lived for hundreds of years are becoming too wet and too salty to grow crops on in some cases. And of course, the forest resources are being lost, and in some cases people are forced to move from their homes as the land becomes too flooded.
So ghost forests have become eerie symbols of rapid change. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to a special fall fund drive edition, KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 15th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Margot Reed. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Megan Kamrick, Emily Scott, Roz Brown, Mary Sherman, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. That's you. KABU is in the last days of our fall fund drive, which means that now is an important time to become a member and support your local community radio station, please. If you would like to contribute to KBOO, you can go to kabu.fm/give or text KABU to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin. We'll be right back.